Chapter 2. The two needful readjustments. It has been our fate, among all the innumerable generations of mankind, to face the most frightful calamity that has ever befallen the world. There is a basic fact which cannot be denied, and should not be overlooked. For a most important deduction must immediately follow from it. That deduction is that we, who have borne the pains, shall also learn the lesson which they were intended to convey. If we do not learn it and proclaim it, then when can it ever be learned and proclaimed, since there can never again be such a spiritual plowing and harrowing and preparation for the seed? If our souls, wearied and tortured during these dreadful 5 years of self-sacrifice and suspense, can show no radical changes, then what souls will ever respond to a fresh influx of heavenly inspiration? In that case the state of the human race would indeed be hopeless, and never in all the coming centuries would there be any prospect of improvement. Why was this tremendous experience forced upon mankind? Surely it is a superficial thinker who imagines that the great designer of all things has set the whole planet in a ferment and strained every nation to exhaustion in order that this or that frontier be moved or some fresh combination be formed in the kaleidoscope of nations. No, the causes of the convulsion and its objects are more profound than that. They are essentially religious, not political. They lie far deeper than the national squabbles of the day. 1,000 years hence those national results may matter little, but the religious result will rule the world. That religious result is the reform of the decadent Christianity of today, its simplification, its purification, and its reinforcement by the facts of spirit communion, and the clear knowledge of what lies beyond the exit door of death. The shock of the war was meant to rouse us to mental and moral earnestness, to give us the courage to tear away venerable shams, and to force the human race to realize and use the vast new revelation which has been so clearly stated and so abundantly proved for all who will examine the statements and proofs with an open mind. Consider the awful condition of the world before this thunderbolt struck it. Could anyone, tracing back down the centuries and examining the record of the wickedness of man, find anything which could compare with the story of the nations during the last 20 years? Think of the condition of Russia during that time, with her brutal aristocracy and her drunken democracy, her murders on either side, her Siberian horrors, her Jew baitings and her corruption. Think of the figure of Leopold of Belgium, an incarnate devil who from motives of greed carried murder and torture through a large section of Africa, and yet was received in every court, and was eventually buried after a panegyric from a cardinal of the Roman Church, a church which had never once raised her voice against his diabolical career. Consider the similar crimes in the Putumayo, where British capitalists, if not guilty of outrage, can at least not be acquitted of having condoned it by their lethargy and trust in local agents. Think of Turkey and the recurrent massacres of her subject races. Think of the heartless grind of the factories everywhere, where work assumed a very different and more unnatural shape than the ancient labor of the fields. Think of the sensuality of many rich, the brutality of many poor, the shallowness of many fashionable, the coldness and deadness of religion, the absence anywhere of any deep, true spiritual impulse. Think, above all, of the organized materialism of Germany, the arrogance, the heartlessness, the negation of everything which one could possibly associate with the living spirit of Christ as evident in the utterances of Catholic bishops, like Hartmann of Cologne, as in those of Lutheran pastors. Put all this together, and say if the human race has ever presented a more unlovely aspect. When we try to find the brighter spots, they are chiefly where civilization, as apart from religion, has built up necessities for the community, such as hospitals, universities, and organized charities, as conspicuous in Buddhist Japan as in Christian Europe. We cannot deny that there has been much virtue, much gentleness, much spirituality in individuals. But the churches were empty husks, which contained no spiritual food for the human race, and had in the main ceased to influence its actions, save in the direction of soulless forms. This is not an over-colored picture. Can we not see, then, what was the inner reason for the war? Can we not understand that it was needful to shake mankind loose from gossip and pink teas, and sword worship, and Saturday night drunks, and self-seeking politics and theological quibbles, to wake them up, and make them realize, that they stand upon a narrow knife edge between two awful eternities, and that, here and now, they have to finish with make-beliefs, and with real earnestness and courage face those truths which have always been palpable where indolence, or cowardice, or vested interests have not obscured the vision. Let us try to appreciate what those truths are, and the direction which reform must take. It is the new spiritual developments which predominate in my own thoughts, but there are two other great readjustments which are necessary before they can take their full effect. On the spiritual side, I can speak with the force of knowledge from the beyond. On the other two points of reform, I make no such claim. The first is that in the Bible, which is the foundation of our present religious thought, we have bound together the living and the dead, and the dead has tainted the living. A mummy and an angel are in most unnatural partnership. There can be no clear thinking, and no logical teaching until the old dispensation has been placed on the shelf of the scholar, and removed from the desk of the teacher. It is indeed a wonderful book, in parts the oldest which has come down to us, a book filled with rare knowledge, with history, with poetry, with occultism, with folklore. But it has no connection with modern conceptions of religion. In the main, it is actually antagonistic to them. Two contradictory codes have been circulated under one cover, and the result is dire confusion. The one is a scheme depending upon a special tribal god, intensely anthropomorphic and filled with rage, jealousy and revenge. The conception pervades every book of the Old Testament. Even in the Psalms, which are perhaps the most spiritual and beautiful section, the psalmist, amid much that is noble, sings of the fearsome things which his God will do to his enemies. He shall go down alive into hell. There is the keynote of this ancient document, a document which advocates massacre, condones polygamy, accepts slavery, and orders the burning of so-called witches. Its Mosaic provisions have long been laid aside. We do not consider ourselves accursed if we fail to mutilate our bodies, if we eat forbidden dishes, fail to trim our beards, or wear clothes of two materials. But we cannot lay aside the provisions, and yet regard the document as divine. No learned quibbles can ever persuade an honest, earnest mind that that is right. One may say, Varian knows that that is the old dispensation, and is not to be acted upon. It is not true. It is continually acted upon, and always will be so long as it is made part of one sacred book. William II acted upon it. His German God which wrought such mischief in the world was the reflection of the dreadful being who ordered that captives be put under the harrow. The cities of Belgium were the reflection of the cities of Moab. Every hard-hearted brute in history, more especially in the religious wars, has found his inspiration in the Old Testament. Smite and spare not. Ni for an eye, how readily the texts spring to the grim lips of the murderous fanatic. Francis on St. Bartholomew's Night, Alva in the Lowlands, Tilly at Magdeburg, Cromwell at Drogheda, the Covenanters at Philippa, the Anabaptists of Munster, and the early Mormons of Utah, all found their murderous impulses fortified from this unholy source. Its red trail runs through history. Even where the New Testament prevails, its teaching must still be dulled and clouded by its sterner neighbor. Let us retain this honored work of literature. Let us remove the taint which poisons the very spring of our religious thought. This is, in my opinion, the first clearing which should be made for the more beautiful building to come. The second is less important, as it is a shifting of the point of view, rather than an actual change. It is to be remembered that Christ's life in this world occupied, so far as we can estimate, 33 years, whilst from his arrest to his resurrection, was less than a week. Yet the whole Christian system has come to revolve round his death, to the partial exclusion of the beautiful lesson of his life. Far too much weight has been placed upon the one, and far too little upon the other, for the death, beautiful, and indeed perfect, as it was, could be matched by that of many scores of thousands who have died for an idea, while the life, with its consistent record of charity, breadth of mind, unselfishness, courage, reason, and progressiveness is absolutely unique and superhuman. Even in these abbreviated, translated, and second-hand records, we receive an impression such as no other life can give, an impression which fills us with utter reverence. Napoleon, no mean judge of human nature, said of it, "He is different with Christ. Everything about him astonishes me. His spirit surprises me, and his will confounds me. Between him and anything of this world there is no possible comparison. He is really a being apart. The nearer I approach him, and the closer I examine him, the more everything seems above me. It is this wonderful life, its example and inspiration, which was the real object of the descent of this high spirit onto our planet. If the human race had earnestly centered upon that instead of losing itself in vain dreams of vicarious sacrifices and imaginary falls, with all the mystical and contentious philosophy which has centered round the subject, how very different the level of human culture and happiness would be today. Such theories, with their absolute want of reason or morality, have been the main cause why the best minds have been so often alienated from the Christian system and proclaimed themselves materialists. In contemplating what shocked their instincts for truth, they have lost that which was both true and beautiful. Christ's death was worthy of his life and rounded off a perfect career, but it is the life which he has left as the foundation for the permanent religion of mankind. All the religious wars, the private feuds, and the countless miseries of sectarian contention would have been at least minimized, if not avoided, had the bare example of Christ's life been adopted as the standard of conduct and of religion. But there are certain other considerations which should have weight when we contemplate this life and its efficacy as an example. One of these is that the very essence of it was that he critically examined religion as he found it, and brought his robust common sense and courage to bear in exposing the shams and in pointing out the better path. That is the hallmark of the true follower of Christ, and not the mute acceptance of doctrines which are, upon the face of them, false and pernicious, because they come to us with some show of authority. What authority have we now, save this very life, which could compare with those Jewish books which were so binding in their force, and so immutably sacred, that even the misspellings or pen slips of the scribe were most carefully preserved? It is a simple obvious fact that, if Christ had been orthodox, and had possessed what is so often praised as a childlike faith, there could have been no such thing as Christianity. Let reformers who love him take heart as they consider that they are indeed following in the footsteps of the Master, who has at no time said that the revelation which he brought, and which has been so imperfectly used, is the last which will come to mankind. In our own times an equally great one has been released from the center of all truth, which will make as deep an impression upon the human race as Christianity, though no predominant figure has yet appeared to enforce its lessons. Such a figure has appeared once, when the days were ripe, and I do not doubt that this may occur once more. One other consideration must be urged. Christ has not given his message in the first person. If he had done so, our position would be stronger. It has been repeated by the hearsay and report of earnest but ill-educated men. It speaks much for education in the Roman province of Judea that these fishermen, publicans and others could even read or write. Luke and Paul were, of course, of a higher class, but their information came from their lowly predecessors. Their account is splendidly satisfying in the unity of the general impression which it produces, and the clear drawing of the Master's teaching and character. At the same time, it is full of inconsistencies and contradictions upon immaterial matters. For example, the four accounts of the resurrection differ in detail, and there is no orthodox learned lawyer who dutifully accepts all four versions who could not shatter the evidence if he dealt with it in the course of his profession. These details are immaterial to the spirit of the message. It is not common sense to suppose that every item is inspired, or that we have to make no allowance for imperfect reporting, individual convictions, oriental phraseology, or faults of translation. These have, indeed, been admitted by revised versions. In his utterance about the letter and the spirit, we could almost believe that Christ had foreseen the plague of texts from which we have suffered, even as he himself suffered at the hands of the theologians of his day, who then, as now, have been a curse to the world. We were meant to use our reasons and brains in adapting his teaching to the conditions of our altered lives and times. Much depended upon the society and mode of expression which belonged to his era. To suppose in these days that one has literally to give all to the poor, or that a starved English prisoner should literally love his enemy the Kaiser, or that because Christ protested against the lax marriages of his day, therefore two spouses who loathe each other should be forever chained in a life servitude and martyrdom, all these assertions are to travesty his teaching, and to take from it that robust quality of common sense which was its main characteristic. To ask what is impossible from human nature is to weaken your appeal when you ask for what is reasonable. It has already been stated that of the three headings under which reforms are grouped, the exclusion of the old dispensation, the greater attention to Christ's life as compared to his death, and the new spiritual influx which is giving us psychic religion, it is only on the latter that one can quote the authority of the beyond. Here, however, the case is really understated. In regard to the Old Testament, I have never seen the matter treated in a spiritual communication. The nature of Christ, however, and his teaching, have been expounded a score of times with some variation of detail, but in the main as reproduced here. Spirits have their individuality of view, and some carry over strong earthly prepossessions which they do not easily shed. But reading many authentic spirit communications, one finds that the idea of redemption is hardly ever spoken of, while that of example and influence is forever insisted upon. In them Christ is the highest spirit known, the Son of God, as we all are, but nearer to God, and therefore in a more particular sense his Son. He does not, save in most rare and special cases, meet us when we die. Since souls pass over, night and day, at the rate of about 100 a minute, this would seem self-evident. After a time we may be admitted to his presence, to find a most tender, sympathetic and helpful comrade and guide, whose spirit influences all things, even when his bodily presence is not visible. This is the general teaching of the other world communications concerning Christ, the gentle, loving and powerful spirit which broods ever over that world which, in all its many spheres, is his special care. Before passing to the new revelation, its certain proofs and its definite teaching, let us hark back for a moment upon the two points which have already been treated. They are not absolutely vital points. The fresh developments can go on and conquer the world without them. There can be no sudden change in the ancient routine of our religious habits, nor is it possible to conceive that a congress of theologians could take so heroic a step as to tear the Bible in twain, laying one half upon the shelf and one upon the table. Neither is it to be expected that any formal pronouncements could ever be made that the churches have all laid the wrong emphasis upon the story of Christ. Moral courage will not rise to such a height. But with the spiritual quickening and the greater earnestness which will have their roots in this bloody passion of mankind, many will perceive what is reasonable and true, so that even if the Old Testament should remain, like some obsolete appendix in the animal frame, to mark a lower stage through which development has passed, it will more and more be recognized as a document which has lost all validity, and which should no longer be allowed to influence human conduct, save by way of pointing out much which we may avoid. So also with the teaching of Christ, the mystical portions may fade gently away, as the grosser views of eternal punishment have faded within our own lifetime, so that while mankind is hardly aware of the change, the heresy of today will become the commonplace of tomorrow. These things will adjust themselves in God's own time. What is, however, both new and vital are those fresh developments which will now be discussed. In them may be found the signs of how the dry bones may be stirred, and how the mummy may be quickened with the breath of life. With the actual certainty of a definite life after death, and a sure sense of responsibility for our own spiritual development, a responsibility which cannot be put upon any other shoulders, however exalted, but must be borne by each individual for himself, there will come the greatest reinforcement of morality which the human race has ever known. We are on the verge of it now, but our descendants will look upon the past century as the culmination of the Dark Ages, when man lost his trust in God, and was so engrossed in his temporary earth life, that he lost all sense of spiritual reality. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.